Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Politics Uncensored. I'm your host, Ali Milani, and we have a brilliant show for you this week. Joining us later is Jeremy Corbyn, former leader of the Labour Party, MP for Islington North. And we've got a long interview with him talking about life and poetry, most importantly. He's got a new poetry book out now, and we're going to go through some of that and some of his life experiences. But before we get to Jeremy, I've got in studio with me political correspondent at the New Statesman, Freddie Hayward. Freddie, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
How is the political world doing?
It's been crazy. It's been a crazy week. We thought it was all sort of dying down. Everything's been in stasis, a bit of a holding pattern.
Mate, when was the last time politics was normal in Britain?
I remember once. It was, I think it was January.
It was the night before the Brexit vote, I think. But yeah, I mean, it just seems like every week there's a new scandal.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this is the part of the problem with the Conservative Party at the moment, that it's just inundated, riddled with scandal that can't escape the past 13 years.
Yeah, and speaking of scandal, where else better to start than Suella Braverman? So Suella Braverman has accused Rishi Sunak of betraying the UK when it comes to key policies and pledges over immigration. Braverman was sacked by Sunak on Monday and replaced by James Cleverly in a shock move. The former Prime Minister Lord Cameron was appointed as Foreign Secretary despite not being an MP or a Lord. Other new moves include Victoria Atkins as the new Health Secretary and Steve Barclay has been demoted to Environmental Secretary. Can I ask you first, Freddie, did you see the sacking coming? I think most people suspected it might happen, didn't know if he had the spine to kind of do it and face off the right of his party. And then I don't think anyone saw Cameron coming.
No, Suella Braverman being sacked was expected. I mean, we've got to remember that when Rishi first appointed her, it wasn't because they were allies or best friends. It's because he needed to shore up his support on the right of the party. Cameron's appointment, I think, was a surprise to everyone. There had been some, you know, conversation, I think, maybe 6 or 7 months ago, speculation that he was perhaps getting advice from George Osborne. We know there's lots of connections in his number 10 setup between the coalition years and what we're seeing at the moment. But appointing the former Prime Minister
When he came out the door of the car, it was like the Royal Rumble and a return of, like, a wrestler comes in last minute. I don't think anyone saw it coming.
It was unbelievable. I was actually doing a podcast at the time. We saw it came up and you were like, okay, Lord Cameron's arrived.
And what do you think this means for Rishi? Because obviously, it seems like his political strategy is all over the place. They were playing a little bit to more of the narrative of the right wing of the party with the Stop the Boats and Suella. It seems now he might be leaning back towards the centre, the One Nationism with Cameron. What is the thinking behind this move?
Well, I think you're right to say that Sunak's political strategy at the moment is deeply incoherent. If we look back to the
we're on reset speech, number 65 or
we are, and we're not sure where it's going. The conference speech, 1 minute he was talking about smoking, the next he was talking about cars, the next he was talking about 20 mile an hour limits in Wales. There was no coherent message to the people. It wasn't like, this is what the country's going to look like in 5 years' time. I completely agree. Why is Cameron there? Well, it's almost like they feel they've not done a great job, so they have to go back to someone who's done it before. I think it does speak to the desperation within number 10. It's not as if...
But this is all coming out from the polls, isn't it? They're in such a dire position in the polls that they're continuously, it seems like, searching for anything that will show signs of life and recovery.
Yeah, completely. But if you do want to recover in the polls, then you need a consistent strategy.
Yeah.
You've got to have a message. It has to be simple. It has to be, you know, get Brexit done or whatever it is, take back control. It has to be a message that's succinct, clear, speaks to what people's concerns are. Are people really waking up every day going, oh my God, I wish 14-year-olds weren't able to smoke in 10 years' time? No, they're thinking about the cost of living, they're thinking about the economy, they're thinking about the fact they can't pay their bills. That's at the top of their
priorities. I also think people don't really know what to make of Rishi. He's not really set his master. Like you said, he's jumping between strategies, jumping between policies. And overall, I think he polls a little bit better than his party, but it's pretty dire at the moment.
They're converging as well.
Do you think there's any route to a recovery for him? Because I guess if I was advising the Conservative Party, and God forbid that will never happen, but and they wouldn't,
they might be
for,
listening right now,
and they probably wouldn't ask for this advice. But it does seem that while Labour does have a huge amount of support in the polls, a lot of that is, let's say, tentative support. There's not a huge amount of enthusiasm behind Labour. That's certainly what the messaging has been. Is there any way back for the Tories?
I think it's really difficult. I think you need some major event, something seismic that would shift politics at the moment. This was one of the key periods in politics to change that, and we've not seen the Conservatives do that. And the thing is now that they're running out of time. Mm-hmm. So it's piling pressure on that short campaign, those 6 weeks before the election, for them to turn something around. We know campaigns can be very important. Look back to 2017 with Theresa May and with Jeremy Corbyn, and look how the dial shifted in that campaign. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see that happen with Rishi Sunak? No, he's just quite a competent communicator. No one really loves him. He's also quite similar to Keir Starmer. I can't see the contrast between them really shifting the dial much. So they need something major, and I just don't think they're gonna pull out the bag.
And speaking of Sir Keir Starmer, he's had his own problems this week in Parliament and over the last month or so. So he's suffered a major rebellion over his stance on the Israel-Gaza war, with 56 of his MPs voting for an immediate ceasefire. Jess Phillips, Afzal Khan, Yasmin Qureshi are among the shadow cabinet's members who have quit their roles to back the ceasefire motion by the SNP. 10 of the party's front benches have left their jobs over the vote. 19 supported publicly a ceasefire. Some didn't vote for it, obviously, including 8 ministers. Sakir has instead backed pauses to the conflict and the delivery of aid. How much should we look into this rebellion? 56 is quite significant, and it's probably one of the bigger ones under his leadership.
It is. It's the biggest. And there have been 10 front benches. No shadow cabinet members, but 10 front benches who have had to resign because they wanted to support the cause for a ceasefire. I don't think it's that surprising. This has been rumbling on for quite a while now. I also don't think it's actually that threatening for Keir Starmer. It's obviously not great. It makes him look as if he's got quite a divided party on this issue, and he definitely does. Is that going to bleed into disunity on other issues? Is it going to bleed into disunity on the NHS tax? I don't think it will necessarily. That's been the leader of the opposition's office's plan for a long time, to try and, you know, restrict this outbreak of rebellion to this issue. And I think it seems as if, particularly with this prospect of going into government, that they'll be able to do that.
Do you think Keir's strategy will be, between now, look, an election, let's say 4 or 5 months, 12 months maximum, is the strategy just do no harm, let them end their own political careers across the aisle?
Yeah, and I think so, in part. Yeah, definitely. And that's proving extremely successful. They're doing so well in the polls. I think the strategy as well is to try and balance that desire within the country for security, the recognition that the past 10 years, 13 years has been a failure economically, the fact that so many people feel insecure in their jobs, that they don't feel as if they've had a pay rise in so long, the fact that we've seen trade unions being broken down in the past 5 years. It's tapping into that. And also recognising that there's a scepticism in the country about Labour.
People don't really know what to make of him either, perhaps more than Rishi.
Perhaps. I think that's...
I mean, the polling and the focus groups suggest, I mean, we saw his word bubble on the Sunday programme.
Never trust a word bubble. That's bad.
But the sense is folks don't know what to make of him, what he stands for and what positions he holds. But you don't, from your body language and your response, you don't seem like that's a particular problem, you don't think, or might not be true.
Yeah, well, either or both. I think people are getting to know what he thinks more and more. The more that he can stand up and say, we kick Jeremy Corbyn out of the Labour Party, the more he can stand up and say, this is my position on Gaza and Israel, the more...
Also, his conference speech. There seemed like a little bit more meat on that bone.
There was. I mean, and also, he has gone on a bit of a journey in the past 2 years. He has flip-flopped around massively. Yeah. You look at the U-turns that he's gone through, look at what he said during his leadership campaign, and look what he's saying now. They're completely different things. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean what he's saying right now, he doesn't believe, but you've got to pick one. But no, I think people are getting to learn the message. And there is a message there. It is, as I was saying earlier, it's about security. It's about how can we involve a more active state in the economy? How can we ensure there's economic growth around the country?
And it seems a lot of the strategy is also to break down the anxiety that Conservative voters will have in jumping across to Labour. So he's made an active effort to make that jump, that leap, a hop, if you will. If not in policy, certainly in culture.
Yeah, completely. So they had to do it on two fronts. On the economics, they had to do that because people saw the 2019 manifesto, and whatever you think about that, they thought it was too much. Mm-hmm. They thought the spending wasn't costed. Whatever you think about, that was the impression.
I can hear John McDonnell screaming into his pillow. Sorry,
he'll understand what I'm saying. Yeah. I think.
Well, I think. Look, I think even Labour and even John and others have admitted, not that it wasn't costed, because it was. They would argue that it was costed, and I agree. But that there was too much in it.
Exactly. It's the impression. The impression is what Keir Starmer now has to grapple with.
Yeah.
And so he has that on the economy. That's why you get all this hesitance around fiscal rules and taxation, for whether that's right or wrong in terms of policy. Then they also have to deal with the cultural side.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that they've done that, for instance, they've U-turned on self-ID for trans people. They've also stopped speaking about race as much as they used to in the, you know, racial inequality in society. So there has been a shift mm-hmm. on that messaging, and there's also been a greater recognition of Brexit. There's been an emphasis on community, national stories, so, these sorts of things.
Last questions I'll ask you, just your sense. There are rumblings within Westminster that Keir is going to be a more liberal prime minister than he appears now. That this is all about, you know, making that jump from Conservative to Labour voters a little bit easier, and in fact he will be a more, I don't think anyone would accuse him of being radical, but perhaps slightly more left than he's appearing now. Do you think there's any credence to that argument? I mean, I don't, but...
Well, it's interesting. You use the word liberal. I think Keir Starmer has an authoritarian streak in him. He is a figure of the state. He has run a massive public service before that put criminals away. That was his instinct. Mm-hmm. So on the liberal side of things, I think we should look at that. On whether he'll be more left-wing, I think it might just be the case that the circumstances in the country force him to be more active on
dealing with the NHS, dealing with the housing crisis, dealing with the economy.
The most ambiguous thing on Labour's platform right now is their fiscal rules, which I bang on about all the time. People think it's extremely boring, but it's also the most important thing because it's going to dictate how much money the government spends on hospitals, on roads, on everything that everyone experiences politics in the day to day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I hope we can have you back on because you've been brilliant. That's Freddie Hayward, political correspondent at The New Statesman. Joining us next, we've got a big interview, and that is Jeremy Corbyn, former leader of the Labour Party, MP for Islington North. He joined me for a long interview, and rather than policy, one of the things that we wanted to speak about was get to know Jeremy the man, what it was like being leader, what that personal experience was like, because he's had plenty of interviews where he's talked about all the top issues that you will know about him, but I wanted to get deep under the sort of hood and get to know what it was like being the man, and he joined us earlier today. So joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Member of Parliament for Islington North, leader and now poet, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
First of all, how are you?
Very, very well, thank you. As you see me.
Yes. Well, I was going to start this. If it was anyone else, I'd be starting this with, you know, post-leadership years, you must be having a lot of time off and relaxing, but it seems like your schedule is just as busy as it was when you were leader of the party.
I'm shocked at the question, actually. Yeah. No, my whole life has always been very occupied and very busy, and now is no different to any other time.
Yeah, and so you're still at the front line fighting the good fights.
Obviously, the MP for my area, and takes up a lot of time anyway. Doing a lot of stuff in Parliament, a lot of campaigning work, and building up the Peace and Justice Project, which is going extremely well.
Mm.
And working on a book I'm writing myself, which is going well.
Yeah,
we're nearly at the final editing stage. And this book we've just produced, Poetry.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about the poetry book. I actually didn't know that you were writing another book. Is that a memoir or...?
It's no, not exactly. It started out as an analysis of the 5 years of leadership of the Labour Party. But somebody pointed out to me you couldn't really talk about that without putting it in the context of the political events that went before and of your own life.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I then started writing a chapter about my own political activities, and after this chapter got into the several tens of thousands of words, somebody suggested you make it into several chapters.
You should probably then, once you're in the tens of thousands of words,
I don't really think most chapters should go beyond about 5,000 words. So anyway, the book is going extremely well, fascinating to do, and it will give, if you like, a balanced, I hope, view of a lot of things and my side of the story.
Yeah, so I do kind of want to look back a little bit and then look, as a result, look forward, because I think you have one of the most interesting stories in British political world, certainly of my lifetime. And so I want to kind of look back at your time as an MP, as leader of the party, and then that's probably informed the book that you've written, but also the themes of the poetry book, which we're going to talk about as well, which was brilliant and I read. Can you give me a little bit of your sense of your history Islington North. I know how important your constituency is to you. I think that's one of the key things, even throughout your leadership years, and from everybody that I speak to in your area, because I'm not that far from it. Mm. How did the story in Islington North start for you? Councillor, activist?
I didn't set out in life to become a member of parliament. That wasn't my sort of life's ambition. I was obviously active in the Labour Party. I was a councillor. I was a union organiser. And I'd done lots and lots of jobs. Then when the previous MP for Islington North, a gentleman called Michael O'Halloran, was left the Labour Party and joined the SDP, and then the party then had to select a candidate, a group of comrades approached me and said, would you put my name forward? I thought about it and thought about it, said, all right. And then we had the longest selection process ever. We had 6 months.
6 months selection process?
Yes. Selection. It started in September 81. At the time, Tony Benn was challenging for deputy leadership of the party, and I was obviously very involved in his campaign, and it finished in March 82.
It's like a Premier League season.
Absolutely.
Why was it so long?
Well, they wanted to make sure everybody had a say, and everybody duly did have a say.
Was there a lot of candidates?
Yeah, there were a lot of candidates. And eventually, it was done by a general management committee delegate voting. And eventually, I got it by 39 votes to 35 on the sixth ballot.
On the sixth. Did you think you were going to win when you put your name forward?
No.
No.
No, you can't go into something like that assuming you're going to win. If you do, you certainly lose.
Yeah.
No, I said, look, I just said, look, this is me. Here I am. This is what I think about.
Yeah. Because when I did it in Uxbridge, under your leadership, the way I was convinced to do it was, you run and just put the ideas on the table, and then the eventual winner will take it on, similar, I think, to your leadership bids. And it was the same for you then. You were just putting the ideas forward.
So I put the ideas then. I was a councillor in the neighbouring borough, so I obviously had some knowledge, quite a lot of knowledge of the area. And I found it interesting doing these discussions and debates, and the number of points that I brought out from it was that the MP has to be rooted in the community. They have to be involved in the community, and they have to try and represent it. But above all, they mustn't never go away from the community, mm-hmm. which is why during all of the time, my office, the only time I ever get irritated with my office is if they take time away from the constituency. Mm-hmm. And when I was leader of the party, we had this golden rule that at least one full day a week would be in Islington North. And they said, can't do that. So I said, no, I'm sorry, this is a rule that will not
but you
be,
know it's
this is a rule that will not be broken.
It's not, I think that the reason that that's important, it's not just that, you know, it allows you to stay connected to the community from an electoral perspective, but it keeps your ear to the ground. You get to hear from real people, right?
Also people I've known for a very long time.
Yeah.
And these are, you know, people in different communities, jobs, industries, businesses, all that. Yeah. I know them all very, very well. Yeah. And they will tell me what they think. And I trust their opinions.
And that difference is really interesting. I remember, and again, just one of my personal stories, I did one of the Sunday programs. When my campaign kicked off, I went on the Sunday program and I bombed. I was terrible, right? Mm-hmm. And I had a canvassing session straight after. And I drove back and I was in sweats. I thought I'd ruin everything. I thought I'd screwed you up and you were going to get, you're going to get shit because of my performance. And then I started knocking on doors and realized, no one watched it, right? They had far too much in their own lives going on, from like feeding the kids and affording uniforms and things like that, to pay attention to Westminster.
Yeah.
So I wonder, you know, you've had such a long and you've been through different eras in British politics. That Westminster bubble, you got to tell me what that's like when you... Because it's not real life.
It's kind of unreal. I remember very early on, I'd been elected about couple of months or so. So this would have been summer 83. I went to a meeting of a tenants association in July. And the association meeting started about 7:30. And it went on a bit and so on. It came towards 9 o'clock. And I said to the chair, look, I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to go now. Why? I said, well, I've got to go to Parliament because there's a very important vote at 10 o'clock. and I think I should be there taking part in that vote. So I really have to go now because I've got to get there. Is that all right? I said, no. I said, well, this is a bit difficult, but I understand you've got some issues you still want to discuss, but we've already been here 2 hours. Mm-hmm. I said, And this woman said, Jeremy, listen, I met you just before the election, and you told me you're going to be for round here. I didn't realise you were also going to get mixed up with Westminster.
What did you think you were doing? Right.
So she said, well, this time is all right, but, you know, just think. Yeah. I just realised that, I mean, it was partly said in joke and jest, but also there is a point that is very easy to become totally absorbed with the minutiae of Westminster.
Yeah.
And if you enjoy that kind of thing, it can be fascinating. Well, if you love gossip.
The problem with it is they're so disconnected. Yeah. And like, I'll give you an example. I won't mention who because it's unfair. But I spoke to the senior advisor to one of the shadow ministers, front benchers, about the situation going on in Gaza. And I said, you know, do they know the amount of emails and outrage within the communities? And the advisor told me, no, because we're not showing them the emails. We're keeping it from them, right? So to kind of protect them from the stress and outrage of what's going on. And that led me to think, hang on, this person presumably spends most of their time in Westminster, right? So isn't actually interacting a whole lot with the community. And then they're not even seeing the emails. So it's so easy to then just get caught in that bubble, isn't it? To just think that that's what everyone else is thinking. The tea rooms of the House of Commons is what everyone else is thinking. And that's where the divide in politics comes.
Like the point you were making about your canvassing session after the interview. In reality, I'm in Parliament some days and there's like most massive furore about some process or other. Everybody's yakking all the time. And then
the rest of the country doesn't care.
Perhaps I'd be...
Yeah. So what? The bit that they care about is when they go to pay their energy bill, for example, and can't afford it.
Or can't get a house.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, look, you did go to Westminster in the end, and you spent quite a lot of time campaigning on the issues that you were really passionate about. But eventually, we get to the 2015 leadership election. And we've had John McDonnell on here, kind of talked us through how that went and the beginning processes and from his perspective, what it was like. What I'd love to hear from you is, look, again, kind of like when you ran for MP, you didn't think you were going to win that leadership, did you?
Well, no, we put my name forward because I was very determined that we put up a challenge. I have to say, many of my colleagues, close colleagues in the Socialist Campaign Group said it's a waste of time, there's no point in doing it.
Yeah.
We even had a meeting of various left groups in Camden one night. It was probably organised by Labour Representation Committee and a whole lot of groups there. And they sort of, oh, no. It's a waste of time. We'll never get it.
We won't even get on the ballot.
What's the point? We should concentrate on doing policy. And I got quite annoyed. And I said, look, guys, if you miss this opportunity to stake your claim to a different form of politics, to stand up against the austerity economics and all this, then forget it on policy in the future because you've lost the chance to raise it at the time when party members are most engaged. And they didn't really agree with me.
Yeah.
And this was like about 2 weeks before the whole thing kicked off. I then went away to the USA for a week on Guantanamo Bay. We were lobbying the Senate and the House. And I went to New York for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So I was away for about a week. And I came back, and they're still having the same discussion. And I said, look, if you don't put up, you can't complain. It's not about me. It's about whoever you decide to put up. So eventually we get to a meeting of the campaign group MPs, which wasn't very big. And they go around the table and say, well, okay, I made the same speech, said somebody's got to do it. So they all said, okay, John, Mac, you do it. You did it last time. He said, no, nope, done all that. I'm not doing that again. Okay. So we then get to look around at Diane.
Yeah, she'd done it before.
She said, I've done that before. I'm not doing it again, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
She said, which is a good endorsement for you.
She said, it's hell doing it. And so there was then a silence, and I bent over and wrote some of my notebook, because I'm kind of inveterate note taker. And I look up, and they're all pointed at me.
You realize you're the last man left in the room.
I said, what's the matter with you guys? they said, well, since you're the one who talked us into this, you better do it.
Mm.
So, all right. And at that point, Diane's hand shot across the table and she pressed something. I said, what was that? She said, I'm just sending out a tweet saying you're running.
Oh, Christ. So, really nailing you to that decision.
No escape from that point onwards. Yeah.
And
well, we had no organization. We had no money. We didn't have anything. We just had my credit card, and that didn't last.
Yeah.
then we just went out there and said, okay, this is to direct the party away from austerity economics into a different form of politics. Mm-hmm. And we had the Nuneaton debate almost straight away. That was Newsnight, early evening Nuneaton debate. With the other candidates, and things began to change very quickly.
At what point did you realise we might win this thing? Was there a moment where you were like...
Yeah, there was. To begin with, I remember talking privately to John and others. I said, well, how do you think we can do? And they were sort of saying, 20, 25%. And I said, it might be better than that, maybe 30.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it began to change was that we'd done... A lot of these, we'd started doing the regional hustings and they'd gone very well. And we organized a public meeting straight after the East Midlands hustings in Nottingham at the Arts Centre. And it was absolutely rampacked half an hour before it was due to begin. And so I thought, sign of something.
Yeah.
And then the hustings got bigger and bigger. And
you were running
beginning to grow.
You were running a kind of different campaign, I remember, because traditionally, I think what the leadership campaigns, they do lots of media and they do the hustings, but you did a lot of community-based events. Right? You pack out rooms and speak directly to the members.
I did public meetings all over the place. There was never a restriction on attendance.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of open-air rallies as well because it was summertime. Yeah. It was easier to do that. And so that changed the atmosphere. When it fundamentally changed was we were in South Wales doing events then. I'd done South Wales, I'd done Welsh Radio that morning, Sunday morning. And then I was going back to the station in Cardiff and I got a call from Unite to say the Unite executive is now nominating you.
Right.
And that was,
that was big, a
very important moment because Unite were then formally backing me. Other unions already said they would, like ASLEF and so on, but Unite came on board at that stage. I was still not convinced we were going to win. I was the last person to be convinced we had a chance of winning, and that was in probably the middle of August. But what I said was, don't imagine we're going to win. The campaign has got to go on.
Yeah.
And we... had all these phone banking sessions. We probably had the biggest phone bank ever. I think we had 600 people on a phone bank one day, that sort of thing. So we did a big campaign and mobilized a lot of people.
Yeah.
But you know the result. It was amazing.
So I've always been curious about this. You win the election.
Mm.
That night, you go home, put the key in the door, open, sit on the couch. Mm. What are you feeling?
Well... we went first of all to Troyer Restaurant at South Bank, and John was there and a lot of other people. I wanted just to say thank you to the team for everything they'd done. And then I got home and thought, oh, wow. And then the next day, there was the first of.
But what are you feeling when you're at home? Is there a little bit of
the
proud
achievement we had made? Very humble to have had this thing. This trust placed
upon me.
Because
it wasn't a small margin of victory either. It was quite a big margin of victory.
It was overwhelming, And then I was just sort of starting to think of all the issues we're going to face and all the problems we would get and the difficulties, but also the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity to develop our political system in a much more open way and open up particularly for marginalized communities. Fundamentally, it's one for everybody.
Yeah.
Then the next argument was about the following morning, because I was told by the Labour Party head office that the tradition was the newly elected leader went to do Andrew Marr the next morning.
All right.
And I said, well, so what? And they said, well, you've got to do it. I said, no, I've already booked to do a mental health day event with the Camden Islington mental health group.
Mm.
And to talk about mental health.
Yeah.
So I'll do that.
And immediately after, you went to the refugee event. Yeah.
Immediately after I was elected, I said, well, I'm going to start as I'm going to go on. I'm going to speak at the Refugees Are Welcome rally in Parliament Square, which I did.
Yeah.
I have to say, a lot of my team didn't want me to do that because they said it's difficult security-wise and crowds and things. But, you know.
Have you ever been concerned about
you? I'm going to do it.
Have you ever been concerned about your security?
Not really, no. I mean, you can't go around always being worried about your own security, because if you do, you end up never going anywhere.
But I imagine your family have always been concerned about it, right?
My loved ones and family, and my wife Laura and my sons are continually worried about this. And we have had...
I can imagine.
We've had some very unpleasant incidents.
But
you know, 90% of it is the opposite.
No, I imagine 90% of it will be...
Yeah.
Positive, right? And what
are those?
The safest
place I feel is Islington.
Islington North, right? Yeah. So I want to kind of look back on your leadership years. I totally reject this idea that because we didn't win in 2019, that nothing was achieved in the 5 years of leadership. And I'll give you a few examples as to what I think. Even if you think away from policy, I mean, there were lots of things that you got the government to U-turn on. I also think it's worth bearing in mind, a lot of people don't know that during COVID, the scheme where people got paid, it's gone out of my head now, the name of it, was actually a policy idea that came from us.
That's fair. Thank you. That's absolutely right. Well, we achieved some significant policy changes. We opened up a whole debate about austerity economics and so on, and the idea that austerity economics has got to lower living standards rather than redistribute power and wealth. And actually, the Financial Times conceded that. Mm-hmm. They said, thanks to the efforts of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn to challenge austerity economics, things have changed. Yeah. It's no longer that easy.
But that's so important, because I think, I remember when Ed was leader, and we gave up the space, and I'm not having a go at Ed, but I think the whole party did this. We gave up the austerity space. Yeah. Because we weren't anti-austerity, we moved the norm in our political space where it became almost impossible for people to argue against austerity.
The 2015 election, both parties were committed to a wage freeze in the public sector.
Yeah. Look, I think if we'd adopted an anti-austerity position, we would have won that 2015 election. Mm-hmm. And if, honestly... I think Ed would admit that in his heart as well. And one of the things that's interesting, my perspective, and it is just entirely my perspective, I think once Ed saw your leadership, he felt like maybe he was a little bit too chained to the status quo when he was leader, and he wished he could have gone further. But I want you to look back. So the 5 years, what are some of the proudest achievements?
Proudest issues, Iraq war apology.
Yeah.
Green New Deal policies, getting Parliament to agree on a climate emergency being declared by Britain, the public ownership debate, which is now everybody's in favour of public ownership of rail, mail, water, and energy, being prepared to stand up to issues on foreign policy where we don't go in militarily, instead we go in with an agenda for peace and for change. But above all, of mobilising an awful lot of people to become involved in politics. I've just come from SOAS.
Yeah.
I was doing a reading of law about conflict war, you know, rules of war, reading them out. Hundreds and hundreds of students there. So many of them said, I only got involved in politics during your time as leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so on that, on the mobilisation, I want to show you something. Can we throw... So for those who aren't watching, we're watching you at Glastonbury giving the speech in front of what looks like to me like hundreds of thousands of people. And we won't be able to hear it. I know we've got the hotkey, but you don't have your headphones on. But I'll play this now for you.
Is it on these headphones?
Yeah. Hang on. You want to put that up? What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary.
That is unprecedented in British politics. Our politics just isn't like that, right? It's not America where you get these massive rallies where thousands of people show up. But here, you've got hundreds of thousands of people who, most of them, let's be honest, wouldn't have had politics as one of their top issues that they're interested in their life, even though we know politics affects all of us. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn."
It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. We wrote, the office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it's really necessary for me to come.
Jeremy, just for your security, I have to come.
So we spent a lot of time in discussion with Michael Eavis. Yeah. About how many tickets we could have. He was very generous, to be fair.
But did you think at that point, I could win a general election?
Well, I thought, my God, we've got this, having not won a general election, which is one of the reasons I pushed really hard for an early poll.
Yeah.
It was really exciting to do. But you know what? 6 months later, maybe less than 6 months later, I was at Glastonbury again because Michael invited me to go there to open the social housing units that he'd built with the profits of Glastonbury. Mm-hmm. Well done him.
Yeah.
So I went to open them and meet the new tenants and residents. And then we went to the field.
Yeah.
It was empty. The pyramid stage had gone except for like the skeleton of it.
Right.
And the sheep were there.
Right.
So I stood there in the middle of the field amongst the sheep looking at the stage.
Yeah, which knowing you as well, you love nature, so why not?
I loved it. And you could see Glastonbury tour. And I remember being taken to Glastonbury tour as a kid by my mum and dad.
Yeah.
Because we lived in Wiltshire.
Yeah. And so obviously at that point, I think you think we got a chance at least at a general election. This mobilization, I think, is really, really important because often I think our politics is obsessed with the Westminster game. But one of the things that your leadership did, certainly, without a Jeremy Corbyn leadership, and I don't want to focus on you just as an individual. Obviously, you were the leadership, but you were the leader of a movement, right? Mm-hmm. Without Jeremy Corbyn, I don't think Zara Sultana MP happens. I don't think, for example, Apsana Begum happens. Mm-hmm. There are so many journalists that I know that kind of got inspired into politics that have gone into journalism. And for sure, I can tell you for sure, Ali Milani isn't sat in the studio interviewing now. Is that something that you can look on proudly to say, look, this, I inspired these people to get into politics?
I look very proudly on the way we managed to excite and mobilize so many people. What I always felt was that we were a distance away from the movement we'd created. Mm-hmm. And I wrote in my diary the weekend I was elected, and I'd spent the whole weekend in arguments with people in the Parliamentary Labour Party about appointments and so on. And you sort of realized the problems that was going to be thrown at me. And I felt we're in danger of being so high up the beach, we're too far away from the crowd at the south, at the bottom of it. And all the time, my leadership, there was this problem of the traditions, attitudes of the bureaucracy of the Labour Party, which were pretty hostile to me, gave me a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And the Parliamentary Labour Party, which was very hostile to me from the very beginning. And it was only after the 2017 election, that was 2 years later, things became a bit better because more people have been elected as Labour MPs that were sympathetic.
I want to ask you this, and we'll move on this. Regrets. Looking back, I mean, it's so easy in hindsight to look back and go, I would have done this, this, and this
different. We underestimated the opposition within the Labour Party. I had a belief that all those that worked for the Labour Party would support what we were trying to do. They didn't. They undermined and they tried to weaken it. And dealing with the mainstream media is never easy. We underestimated the malevolence and the hostility of right-wing press in Britain.
I mean, at one point, the Daily Mail ran like a 15-page spread or something.
The Daily Mail, the Daily Express, all of them ran terrible stuff on me day in, day out, and my house was under siege.
What was
sometimes
that like?
Lara couldn't go out at all.
What was that like?
Horrible.
Yeah.
Because you wake up in the morning, most people wake up on a summer's morning hoping to hear a dawn chorus. What do I hear?
Yeah.
Chattering photographers outside. You then jostle and harass. Yeah.
But also, like, you mentioned your wife. Your family often, and I know this because I got maybe 0.5% of it when I ran against Boris, your family end up paying the price for it, don't they?
Absolutely. And it meant that Lara, who is very political, very active, very knowledgeable, got either belittled or abused or attacked and so on. And she's actually a very significant person in her own right, nothing to do with me. And she's a Mexican woman, very interested in Mexico and so on. And obviously she got a lot of attacks, as did my sons.
Yeah. And everyone, I think, and people forget often. I think the media forget.
Them, I mean, in a sense, I can take it because it's me. I chose to do this. They didn't, and the horrors they got. The other thing is, one should be very careful of the insidious language that's used by the media you think you're friends. Now, I wrongly, completely wrongly, assumed that liberal papers, so-called, like The Guardian, would be, I'm not asking for endorsement, not asking for support, at least give us a fair hearing. They didn't.
You didn't feel like they gave you a fair hearing? No. Did anyone give you a fair hearing?
Well, and academic analysis show that only 90% of the media reporting was hostile.
Only that. You got 10%.
Well, no, some of them are neutral.
All right, I'm going to ask you this question. Be honest with me, okay?
Of course.
Looking back, I put you in a time machine, take you back to that room where John said, I'm not doing it, Diane said, I'm not doing it, and you make that decision again. Would you run again?
Yes.
100%?
100%.
You said that without even...
Without a blink, without a delay, without hesitation. This is like just a minute, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it. Well, that tells me exactly where you are. And so I have to ask you a little bit about Keir. I hope you don't mind, because he served in your shadow cabinet. What was it like with him at the time? Did you have a relationship with him?
We appointed him as a shadow Brexit secretary after the referendum. I knew what his views were on Brexit, obviously. And I felt that we were having... going to navigate a difficult path. And I also appointed people to join in the negotiating team with the government who had an opposite point of view to him, John Trickett and Rebecca Long-Bailey, for example. How should I put it? I never felt very close to Keir. He was efficient at analysing the legislation and very quick at that. But was he particularly involved in everything else in every other political discussion? No. Didn't show much interest in all the other issues we're dealing with. Never spoke when we're discussing housing, environment, or anything else. That was it. Was he close? No.
Did you feel like you know, he just had an interest in his own brief and nothing else?
Well, I asked him to do that brief. We went to Brussels together a couple of times, and we had lengthy discussions with Michel Barnier. I felt that we were in quite a good place when I proposed a customs union as a way forward, a sort of a leave EU, have customs union alternative, which would have meant you basically there wouldn't be the disruption of trade. He apparently went along with that and supported that, and indeed was there at the Coventry speech when I proposed that.
Yeah.
But
do you regret?
He's a very different person now than he was then.
Oh, really? Okay. So it's very, very different now. Yeah. Even on a personal level, I assume you guys don't talk now.
Well, he hasn't spoken to me for 2 years.
Or yeah. I have a question just on that Brexit policy. Do you regret the position we ended up with in 2019? Because I tell you what, I supported it. I thought it was the right move at the time. I now think, you know, I was wrong at the time.
Well,
I think we should have stuck to our guns.
Complicated problem to deal with, which ended up on my lap. Problem is, Labour supporters around the country support Labour because they want to see a political change, they want to see social justice. People in my constituency on housing benefit, universal credit are hard up. Most of them voted Remain. People in Easington, in the northeast, on housing benefit, in exactly the same situation, probably voted Leave. Their unity ought to be about progress towards social justice.
Yeah.
So I tried to bring people together on this.
And that bothered me, I remember, because I was in a Leave seat.
Yeah.
And the narrative was, well, everyone who voted Leave was a bunch of racists, right?
Which they're not.
Yeah. But we weren't allowed to say that because the liberal media would hammer you if you said, no, well, they had genuine economic angst and maybe they chose the wrong area to put it in, but
it was
genuine.
They had economic angst. And I remember I was in Cornwall campaigning for a yes vote in the referendum, the Remain and Reform agenda that we put forward. I remember having a discussion with people in Cornwall. Now, Cornwall had a lot of Objective One money from the EU, but is a poor county. No question about that. Wages are very low, jobs are very insecure, and the whole place gets swamped and by property developers buying up second homes and leaving them empty most of the time. So it's there's a lot of unhappiness in Cornwall. And I remember talking to a bunch of people in Truro and other places, and they were all going to vote Leave. And I said, why? He said, there's nothing in it for us. And I got the same in other places. I felt that, in a sense, it was a vote, yes, for a different way of doing things, but it was a vote of anger against communities that had been left behind.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, I think Keir spearheaded the second referendum vote. And I remember this conference speech where he said, you know, Remain would very much be on the table. And I think, I'll be honest with you, I think that was the moment we lost the election in 2019. Because even when I was door knocking, there's nothing that I could say that broke through that Brexit barrier.
We obviously tried to run the election campaign on health, social justice, and all the other issues.
I mean, I laid down in front of a bulldozer to try and get people, but it was just
my
Brexit.
My constituency voted 80% Remain in the referendum.
And
they were concerned. Nobody was happy. Did we make the right call? We made the call that seemed to me a way of bringing the party together. And I have to say, on the eve of the 2019 conference, there was a meeting of TULO, Trade Unions and Labour Organization. All the unions were there that are affiliated to the party, some of whom had been Remain, some of whom had been Leave. Unanimous support for that decision.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, last question on Keir, I promise, because I want to get to the book now. It's looking likely that he might be the next Prime Minister. You worked with him, at least. I mean, you didn't have a particular personal relationship, but you worked with him. If an alien was to come to Earth and you had to describe Keir in one or two words to them, what words would you use?
I would say he's somebody that is very determined to hold on to his position, exercises power in a very personal and quite ruthless way at times, and sees what he believes the right form of winning an election to be an end in itself rather than a means to an end. And I get concerned about that, and concerned about the undermining of democracy in the party and some of the rule changes that he's pushed through. One, for example, which was astonishing, which says the rules of natural justice do not apply to the Labour Party rule book.
Yeah, I mean, I've been on the receiving end of some of those rule changes.
You've been on the receiving end of a lack of natural justice.
I want to get to the book.
And natural justice on me has been rather limited as well.
Yeah, so I want to get to the book because that's the reason we're here. So you've written a book, or you've put together a book with Len McCluskey, Poetry for the Many. Tell us a little bit about how this came together.
Well, Len and I were having a chat in my office one time about economic strategy. We get on very well, so we had a long chat. There wasn't really much debate. We were fundamentally in agreement. Then Len sort of stretches back like this, looks around, and sees my bookcase. He said, "Wait, why have you got all these poetry books in your bookcase?" I said, "Well, I like poetry." He said, "I haven't got that one. Can I borrow it?" Sure, be my guest. And so Len often quotes particularly Emily Dickinson. And he was very interested as to why I quoted from Ben Okri in my conference speech in 2015, just after I'd been elected. And I said, well, I think there's a poet in all of us, and poetry inspires and excites. And too many young people continue writing poetry after leaving primary school, but are embarrassed to say so.
Yeah.
And so we then talked about this quite a lot. And then I said, look, why don't we try with Melissa Benn, because she's ideal for this, to do a poetry evening in Liverpool at the Casa. I said, okay. So we had an evening at the Casa. We booked it. The Casa's a club in Hope Street in Liverpool. Absolutely packed out to the rafters. We could hardly get in ourselves.
Right.
When I thought this thing was going to be a bit of a...
Well, you would think so with poetry. Yeah, yeah, because know, because as you write in your introduction, I think what's interesting about the book, in your introduction, you write about how sometimes poetry is kind of looked down upon, or people are embarrassed, and there are poets in all of us, but people are embarrassed to bring it out.
Yeah, well, that's right. There's a poet in everybody. So we did the event in the Casa. That was really good. Then Colin Robinson from All Books was there, who's an old friend, and he's from Liverpool as well, although he lives in New York now, and he was there because he was seeing his dad. And he said, that was really nice. I enjoyed that. Would you two like to put it into a book? What? I said, well, I'll think about it. So we thought about it and then agreed we would try it, and we would choose poems each, write as to what they meant to us, and then invite other people such as Morag Livingstone, Ken Loach, I've got them here, Gary Young, Maxine Peake, Michael Rosden, and so on, each to choose a poem and say why they loved it. Mm. And so it took longer than I thought it would to put together, and much harder to do than I expected, because it's very hard leaving poems out.
Yeah, and it's a labour of love, right?
Because it's a labour of love. Yeah. And so what I did was I booked quite a lot of evening time and weekend time, and then my desk just became like a poetry library.
Right, yeah.
And I kept phoning people up and saying, have you got the complete works of Brecht? What? Yeah, yeah, I think we have somewhere. Yeah. So I borrow all these books.
So how many poems did you go through? How many are in there in the end?
And there's 20 each.
Did you go through to get to the 20?
Hundreds. I read an awful lot of poetry. I read a lot of poetry anyway, so it was a joy.
So
it was a love and a joy doing it.
It's funny that we talk about this because, so as you know, I come from an Iranian background.
Yeah.
And poetry is a big part in our culture.
Absolutely.
And I grew up with poetry to the point of frustration. My dad, whenever he wanted to tell me off, wouldn't shout, wouldn't tell me off. He'd read poetry to me as a sort of lesson to learn. And one of the big ones he used to say, the translation's awful. It doesn't translate.
Do me a favor, for the next poetry book, will you give us some advice on an Iranian poet?
First of all,
that your dad read to you.
So my dad read my granddad's poetry. My granddad was a poet himself, published poet in Iran. And he had this poem that he always used to say to me. He's passed away now, both my dad and my granddad. But the translation doesn't work, but essentially it would be something like, every day you go to shower and you cleanse your body. One day I wish you'd go to shower and cleanse your soul. And he always used to say this to me, right? As a way of teaching. Whenever I did something bad, he'd say, go into the shower. Don't just cleanse your body, cleanse your soul and come back out. So I know how important poetry can be.
And how powerful.
And how powerful it can be. And I often say in politics, politics is poetry. It's not prose. Yes. And I think nothing encapsulates that better than for the many, not the few. Because
poetry,
of course, where does that come from?
What inspires people. And my whole political message is not about the details of economics, the details of this, details that. It's the spirit that moves people.
Mm-hmm.
And political change does not come from what MPs say to each other in the tea room. Political change comes because of the activity of people in our communities.
But it's also so powerful in terms of a communication message. Me and the producers were sat in the sort of green room before you came in, and I was saying, one of the best lessons that I've learned in politics is that the way to get people to join you in your movement, in your ideas, it's not what you say, it's how you make them feel. And that's the power that I think For the Many, Not the Few as a slogan had, which of course comes from poetry. And that's the power that poetry
it's
has.
It's inspired by Shelley.
Yeah.
That's where it came from.
Yeah.
We spent ages trying to think up something for the 2017 election manifesto.
Yeah. How did you come to it?
Well, we're having a discussion in the office and people come up with various things. I said, none of that. None of that's going to work. I said, you've got to understand what this is about.
Yeah.
This is about people. It's about mobilizing people. It's about giving people hope. It's not about sort of offering an a la carte menu of what's going on. It's about hope, and it's about the holistic approach, and it's about art and everything else. And that's why every one of our rallies had music and so on and so on.
Mm.
And they said, yeah, so what's your favorite poem? I said, well, that's hard, but I suppose you've got to say Shelley. They said, oh, yeah, that bit about many. I said, you got it.
That's the one. That's the one. Right. We're running out of time, so I do want to ask you something.
Yep.
This is the questionnaire that we ask all of our guests, and I'm going to get you to read your poem at the end of the thing, if that's okay. But we ask all of our guests a list of questionnaires. It's from a French series by Bernard Pivot called Boline de Culture, and it's a questionnaire that I love because I think it gives us an insight into the person's mind. And I've asked John this. I've asked Michael Crick, was a journalist who was here. I've asked him. So,
God, he could be irritating, but he's very interesting.
You know, he on the question of Labour Party democracy.
Yeah,
he would never claim to be on the left of the party. He said it here. He said, I actually identify with the right of the party.
Yeah.
But the democratic sort of deficit in the party right now is horrible. Yeah, anyway, absolutely. On this. So, question on Bernard Pivot. First things that come to your mind. What is your favourite word?
No. When people are trying to ask me to do something, I refuse to do.
You can say no. Have you found it hard to say no in your life?
Sometimes.
Yeah. What is your least favourite word?
Local government language describing deficits.
You know what? You said local government. I had flashback to bins. Christ, the amount of emails I got about bins. So what turns you on creatively, spiritually, or emotionally? What's something that gets your juices going in terms of creativity?
Nature, beauty, and imaginative art and poetry.
And what turns you off?
Boring mainstream music.
Oh, right. Anyone you want to name?
No. Most of Radio 2.
Yeah. I'm often told that I have the music taste of an 80-year-old, so I'm not a big fan of modern music either. Okay, so John refused to answer this question, and you can also refuse to answer. What's your favorite curse word or swear word, if you have one? We're allowed to swear on that. You can miss this one
out.
Oh,
damn you.
What sound or noise...
It's quite low-key.
What sound or noise do you hate?
Screech of metal on metal. Like that.
What sound or noise do you love?
Birdsong.
Birdsong, right. Yeah. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt? So if you weren't a politician, what would you like to do?
Probably a farmer.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I know you once gave me some jam. I don't know if you remember, as a candidate, you gave me some jam.
I do.
And my mum particularly loved it. What profession...
Does she want more? Is that a request for more?
if there's going. I'll drive to North London. What profession would you never like to do? So what's the worst profession you can think of? Not that there's anything wrong with it, but you can't see yourself doing it.
I think I'd be the world's worst banker, because I'd be far too generous with the poor customers.
And then, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Welcome, but can you explain what you've been doing?
Right. So I do want to end it. We've been talking about the poetry book, and it's such an important part of why you're here and what you're doing. And you've written a very... I read this two nights ago. You've written a really interesting poem about Calais.
Yeah.
You can either read that or one of your other favorites.
I'd love to. Just to say, the book is dedicated to Julian Assange.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Freedom. And how can people get it? They can get it everywhere, right?
You get it everywhere. Yeah. Buy it directly from Orbooks, buy it online, or access Peace and Justice Project website, thecorbynproject.com, and that will direct you to how to buy it. I chose lots of poems, all of which were beautiful in their own way, some of which are very challenging. Very nice one from Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, a Mexican woman who was... died very young. She was in colonial Mexico, and the Catholic Church hated her because she could read and write, and she wrote up for women's rights, so she was imprisoned. And she died, and then the church destroyed nearly all of her papers, but Octavio Paz and others have managed to recover some. Mm-hmm. So we put her poem in, You Foolish Men.
Oh, nice.
And it was written 100 years before Mary Wollstonecraft came along.
Oh, wow. So I think we're running out of time, so if you could just do a snippet of it.
I feel very, very angry about the way we treat refugees, asylum seekers. I've been to Calais a number of times. And when I came back from one visit to Calais, I wrote a poem. I won't read it all because there isn't enough time. I'll just read the first three verses, if I may. Cold, wet marshlands surround Calais in winter. The poem is called Calais in Winter. So I'll start again. Cold, wet marshlands surround Calais in winter. Police take tents away from the homeless. The railway station is protected with razor wire. Motorways have walls on each side. Trees are cut down to create open land. Huge rocks prevent anyone leaving a road. There is fear in Calais. It stalks every official building. It seeps into the minds of the police. It pervades all thinking. It gives imagination to cold-hearted people to confront the enemy. When they escape to the sea in flimsy boats that would be at home in a small lake, they have to be stopped, with bayonets puncturing them, clothing taken that would protect against the cold. The enemy comes on foot, in lorries and buses, with few clothes, no money and no food, few friends, only memories of bombardment and war, of families in jail, of crops destroyed, of empty schools, of floods and drought, of bitter travelling, in secret lorries, on mountain paths, in safe houses, of razor wires and cameras hidden in trees.
Jeremy Corbyn, MP for Islington North, poet now, and former leader of the Labour Party. I think you began your leadership by going to a refugee, refugees are welcome event, and I can't think of anything more apt to end the interview with you reading your wonderful poem about refugees in Calais. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for joining us.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.